writer Lawrence Maslin of the Tisch School of the Arts in New York suggests that most everyone has a favorite superhero, whether you first fell in love with Tobey Maguire's Peter Parker or Steve Ditko's original version. No matter how you got there, it's a good bet that your first encounter with a superhero made your heart soar a little higher, your life a little more colorful, your dreams a little bolder. It could be that you were still in your PJs one Saturday morning and glimpsed your first superhero on TV. Or maybe he or she burst forth in full Dolby surround sound in the darkened hush of a multiplex. Or it could be that you're one of those young upstarts who are digging your superheroes on those newfangled devices, zooming from panel to panel by swiping your fingers across the screen. But if you've picked up a copy of this book, the odds are good that you've also picked up a comic book at some point in your life. And you probably remember the first time a four-color superhero comic book caught your eye. Maybe it was on a spinning rack on the counter of your friendly neighborhood candy store. Maybe it was on loan to you by a pal in the bunk above yours at summer camp. Perhaps your mom bought it for you in the supermarket, or perhaps you stumbled into a local comic book shop and gasped at the wide array of do-gooders and crime fighters spread out on shelves against the wall. Still, it's hard to believe that superheroes have only been a part of the American culture for less than a century. This companion volume complements our three-hour PBS documentary series titled Superheroes, a Never-Ending Battle. Most of the time, that battle is between the forces of good and the purveyors of evil. But the battle extends into the conflict between art versus commerce, expression versus repression, tradition versus progress. That from the introduction to the companion print volume for a project supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities. Superheroes, a Never-Ending Battle, chronicles the history and evolution of comic book superheroes in the context of American history. The three-hour documentary examines the industrial development of the comic book industry, while also showing how superhero comics both influenced and reflected broader social values regarding race, war, violence, and morality. Superheroes, a Never-Ending Battle premiered over PBS on October 15th, 2013. Young Patrick Hamilton was just the kind of comics lover Maslin describes as we started this conversation. But Avengers was the thing that made him and his heart soar a little higher. Patrick Hamilton is professor of English at Misericordia University in Dallas, Pennsylvania. With Alan Austin, he co-authored All New, All Different, A History of Race and the American Superhero. And he and Dr. Austin are co-hosts of the WVIA podcast, Pop Shop, an engaging, irreverent conversation on popular culture. The April 12th edition happens to focus on Patrick's unfounded speculation on the Avengers Doomsday Edition. The University Press of Mississippi has recently released Dr. Hamilton's study titled simply George Perez. His acknowledgments open the book with his aim. The first comic book I remember buying was Avengers number 164. Which sported a George Perez cover and was the start of my 40-plus years of fandom. Having the opportunity to write a book on Perez, and in particular, revisit his work in Avengers and the New Teen Titans, titles I've followed for decades, was an immense joy and privilege. I hope this book does justice to Perez and what he did in and for comics, as well as spur further investigations into his work. Patrick Hamilton stopped in at the WVIA Benko radio studio after recording the latest Pop Shop episode, and he was excited to introduce us to Perez. And in a nice happenstance, this evening, Disney Plus will present the season finale of Marvel Television's Daredevil Born Again, a series which includes the character Hector Ayala, known as White Tiger, created by George Perez and Bill Mantlow. Well, who then is George Perez?
He's very much a figure in kind of the Bronze Age of comics, which would be like 1970s, 1980s, and worked for sort of the two big companies. So spent a lot of time early in his career with Marvel, which is where your Captain America, Iron Man, Spider-Man would probably be their most recognizable character. But also spent a great deal of time at DC, where that's where Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, those are kind of the two universes, and those four, Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, and then Spider-Man at Marvel, are probably the most iconic superheroes for most people. And so Perez spent the most of his career working at both companies, and really shaping the look, I would say, of comics during the 1980s at both companies as well.
And that's a case that you set out to make and make very well, and it's a case that hasn't been made as you've made it in this book. But you, as a youngster, were drawn into the world of comics, and you say right out at the start, you knew, you encountered him right away.
Yeah, what I kind of consider my first comic book was Avengers number 164 from, I think, 1977, so I would have been all of 4 years old. I'm not really sure how that came about, but my parents would take me to the thrifty store and they would have three packs of comics shrink wrapped together. And so I got one of those, and Avengers 164 was in it with a cover by George Perez. And I consider that my first comic, even though there were two other comics in that pack. I sometimes have to remember what the other two were. And Avengers became my longtime sort of love in comics. If it's the one series that, since I've been continually collecting comics since 1987, I've basically been collecting comics from then till now, still this day, Avengers is the one title I've collected the whole time. And Perez, that's the title that he is most associated with. Most people think, when they think of Perez, they think of Avengers. It's where he began and where he kind of became a first fan favorite. So there's that link as well. But yeah, Avengers has been my love of comics forever.
And there are terms that you use in the book that people who may not be comic collectors might not understand in terms of the difference. Penciler, artist, writer. So just lay them out. What are those? And then what does he do?
Yeah, so it also depends where you're working at, because Marvel had a very different method. In a lot of cases, you know, you have a writer, but sometimes they would give a just very brief discussion of, you know, in this issue, the Avengers fight so-and-so. And then that's given to the artist to draw, you know, from that. And then the writer would also go in once the art is penciled. So Perez would draw it in pencil, and then very often another person would go over and then ink it, which is what you would kind of see in the final product. And then another person would color it. Occasionally Perez would do his own inks, but most of the time he was paired with another inker. And then the writer would go back with the finished art and put in the dialogue balloons and the caption boxes and things like that. So it's definitely kind of a back and forth. And particularly with Perez, when he moved to DC and particularly working on the new Teen Titans title, where he was paired with Marv Wolfman as writer and Perez as the penciler, they eventually just referred to themselves as co-creators, because Perez began to play a much greater role in the storytelling. Some of the things that I talk about in the book, Wolfman actually says, yeah, that was all George. Like, that's his character. That was his sequence that he put together. So even though those jobs are fairly defined, writer comes up with the plot and the script. The penciler is the one who actually draws in pencil the original art. And then the inker is the one that goes back over that with ink. filling in the blacks and things like that. And then the colorist adds the color, the letterer adds the letters. Those lines get blurred a lot of the times, particularly with someone like Perez and Wolfman. They were on Teen Titans for close to 5 years together. So they became much more, they eventually just changed the credits to co-creators. So they were much more equal and kind of working with each other to develop a lot of the stories.
Well, let's go back to young George. He was born in the greater New York area, mm-hmm. right? Tell us his background and how he came to do this work.
Yeah, so he was born in the Bronx to Puerto Rican parents who had immigrated to the United States separately, but then came together and obviously gave birth to George. And then I think the earliest story that Perez had told is that he took some of his early art samples to a comic book convention and showed them to Neil Adams, who was one of the major comic book artists. He overlapped with Perez a lot, so I wouldn't necessarily say he's the generation before, but he kind of overlapped with that generation and then Perez. And Neil Adams looked at his art and basically ripped it to shreds. So that was, you know, that was kind of George's first experience with getting his art evaluated. But he did get fairly early on work at Marvel on some of their minor titles, Creatures on the Loose, which was kind of a sci-fi horror series, Deadly Hands of Kung Fu, where, among other things, he introduced the White Tiger character. And then he eventually graduated to Marvel mainstays like Fantastic Four and then Avengers. He's probably only a few years into his career when he takes on the Avengers for the first time, and then was kind of in and out on Avengers over the next, 5 to 6 years between like the mid-70s and the early 80s.
And the question that you're exploring mm-hmm. as we go along in the book, Patrick, is to what degree he shaped characters in the context of the world mm-hmm. as it was developing in mm-hmm. terms of gender, disability, mm-hmm. race, ethnic things.
Yep.
And he does have contributions mm-hmm. in all of those areas.
Yeah, that sort of became, when I was first working on this project and thinking about a book on Perez, kind of figuring out what the hook for the book would be. And I found when he was nominated for the Will Eisner Hall of Fame, the Eisner Awards being like the big comic book industry awards that are given out at San Diego Comic-Con every year. They have a Hall of Fame. The year he was nominated, you know, there's a little blurb after each of the nominees talking about their accomplishments. And everyone else that year, they were, you know, icons and innovators and things like that. And I remember reading his blurb, and it listed the titles he worked on and that he was known for drawing team books. And writer Peter David said he was his favorite collaborator. And I'm like, there was nothing on par with anyone else. And I found that really interesting because when you're talking about 1980s comics, Perez is definitely one of, if not the artist that people I think would identify as shaping the look of comics in 1980s. He also plays a huge role, as I talk about in the book, in terms of the movies that we've got now. Several movies are based on properties that he did. Infinity War is based on the Infinity Gauntlet series that he drew the first half of. The Wonder Woman movie with Gal Gadot that came out is very much based in the relaunch of Wonder Woman that he did in 1987, 86, I think. And just in general, the way in which particularly the movies today are packing so many characters in, which is something Perez was sort of noted for in his art, was trying to pack as much as he could in, that so much of in comics and kind of what people are encountering in the movies today is influenced and based in the work of Perez. It made me think about, we don't really merit his contribution as much as we should in terms of what he did on the comics page, in terms of layout and style, and then also, as I talk about in the book, race, gender, and disability. I argue in the book that his art is very much, particularly in terms of race and disability, his art is often sort of trying to get away from stereotypical depictions of those, even if the plots that he's working with are still kind of based in some of those stereotypes or problematic understandings.
And George Perez, Latino man, breaking through in a way with Wonder Woman and mm-hmm. creating this, again, remarkable character.
Yeah, I mean, I find it interesting in the credits for the Wonder Woman movie, next to the original creators of Wonder Woman, Perez's name is the only other one singled out above all the other contributors that they acknowledge. And the director has said that she based a lot of the film in Perez's version. Particularly the look of the Amazons is very much based on Perez's art as opposed to the original story. In the original story, they're in very sort of skimpy toga outfits. He has them in the armor that we see in the film. They're very much a warrior culture, very much steeped in Greek mythology. All of that comes from the Perez run, and that in many ways his run is as definitive of who Wonder Woman is as the original creators.
When we talk just about his style, you mm-hmm. talked about getting a lot in.
Oh, yes.
What are the other things that distinguish his work? You look at a page and you say, ah, Perez.
Yeah, so there's a lot of things that we could talk about. One of the things that I talk about in the book is the way that he always works within the dimensions and confines of the comic page. And one of the things, I don't mention this in the book, but one of the things that I think characterizes his art is a kind of legibility, that you always know how to read a Perez page from the page itself. There's other artists, when they're being innovative and changing things, they sometimes will draw arrows between panels because you wouldn't necessarily read them in the right order without those arrows. I don't think they ever had to do that with a Perez page. So he's very much about stretching what you can do on the page. Particularly, I think one of his signatures was vertical panels, is that he has a lot of pages, some of them are in the book, where instead of your typical horizontal arrangement of the panels, they're vertically on the page. And so it sort of stretched things that way, particularly in scenes where they're in sort of different dimensions and things like that. His first issue of Avengers has a sequence where they're fighting Kang the Conqueror, who's a time traveler, and they're in kind of the between time space. And they're in all of like these trapezoidal and very oddly shaped panels for that sequence, kind of reflecting what was going on. And then he was made, because he's very early in his career, Marvel basically said, yeah, no, go back to the Marvel House style, which is your square and rectangular panels arranged horizontally on the page. But particularly when he went to DC to do New Teen Titans and other things, he really had the freedom to really stretch those pages. So one of the things that those vertical panels is something I would say he's known for. And just the sheer amount of detail in a Perez page. There's panels where you have characters fighting in Avengers Mansion, but he's got on the back wall photos or paintings of other characters that are there that, you know, there's always so much detail and what we kind of think of as Easter eggs in Perez's art. And I talk about kind of the way through that he does a couple of things. You know, he embraces what it's possible to do on the comic book page, but also his characters exist in very much built and defined world around them. Even in his early work on Deadly Hands of Kung Fu, you've got scenes where characters are in like their office and it is very detailed, the bookshelves behind them. There's just a sheer amount of detail to Perez's art that you didn't see as much with other artists.
So as a storyteller, he's able to do what you've just described mm-hmm. through his art mm-hmm. while others come and put in the dialogue?
Yes. Yeah, that the dialogue generally would be put in after Perez does the art. It's also one of the reasons why I think his contributions have been underplayed, in that Perez is drawing for Marvel and on a major title like Avengers very early in his career. Like, you can basically look at his early stuff, Deadly Hands, Kung Fu, early Avengers, and you can see he's a very young artist and is sort of developing on the page. In the book, I compare him to Jack Kirby, who is very much of that generation before Perez. But when Kirby was on Fantastic Four and the other titles that kind of made his reputation, Kirby had been working in comics for decades prior to that point. As I say in the book, if we were to look at Perez at a similar time in his career, it would be in the 90s when he did things like Infinity Gauntlet, Hulk Future Imperfect, and the Avengers relaunch, which for many people are, if not the peak, a second peak in his career and where some of his best work was produced. But we've got all of Perez's work for decades prior to that, where he's kind of learning how to be a comic book artist on the fly. And so I think we see more of the rough edges of Perez's early art than we do with other artists on comics like Kirby, who had been drawing in romance comics and other things years prior to being a superhero artist, which is what everyone thinks of him as.
And you use an intriguing word, and the concept is great when you talk about what Perez did with it, geometricize.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's actually from Frederick Aldama, who was my dissertation director back in graduate school. And to be honest, to whom I probably owe much, if not all, of my career. He originally, when we were talking about my next book project, I originally was thinking, oh, maybe I'll do something on White Tiger. And he was the one, he said, no one's really done anything on Perez yet. I'm like, oh, that sounds wonderful. So that's his term in terms of how artists, particularly Latino artists, arrange things spatially on the page. And I sort of borrow that and apply it to Perez, particularly in terms of the Deadly Hands of Kung Fu, when it was led by a trio of characters called the Sons of the Tiger, and how he always had them in triangular arrangements and things like that to kind of create that sense of space and a sense of power and dignity on the page.
And there was also a sense, as you suggest, don't you, that there was an equality, that
yes,
they weren't just all white guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that the original Sons of Tiger were Bob Diamond, who was the Caucasian member. I'm forgetting the other two members' names, but it was an African-American and I believe a Chinese-American. And so, yeah, that particularly in terms of that racial equality, the way they were in that equal sort of triangular relationship is one of the ways that I talk about sort of how Perez, even if he wasn't doing it consciously, kind of implicitly is suggesting a kind of equality between the characters.
Tell us about the Teen Titans and what was so impactful about that.
So, yeah, so the Teen Titans had been a earlier title at DC that had ended, basically featuring all the teen sidekicks of the established heroes. So Batman's sidekick, Robin, the Flash's sidekick, Kid Flash, Aquaman's sidekick, Aqualad, Wonder Girl, who was a spinoff of Wonder Woman, Speedy, who was Green Arrow's sidekick, as an archer as well. And then in 1980, when he came over with Marv Wolfman, they revamped the series and included many of those characters. Robin, Wonder Girl, Kid Flash, and Beast Boy were there, but they also introduced new characters, Starfire, Raven, and Cyborg, that in this day are as, if not more, synonymous with the Teen Titans for most people than some of those original ones that I mentioned. Perez, you know, designed all of them, and for a long time, that was DC's number one selling title. You know, it's coming about the time when X-Men was the number one title at Marvel. New Teen Titans was the one title at DC that kind of rivaled Marvel's X-Men in terms of sales. So it was an immediate success and was where Perez really had the freedom now to stretch himself as an artist. He was no longer confined by Marvel House style, and he felt he was allowed to do more things and really sort of stretch himself and expand his borders as an artist.
What about his own background? Was there a sense that because his roots are in Puerto Rico, even though he was born in the States, that there was an underappreciation of his art because of who he was in terms of perhaps, well, prejudice?
It's one of the things that's kind of interesting about Perez, because he is, in 1980s comics, there's probably three artists that come to mind as defining the art of that. One of them is Perez, one of them is John Byrne, and the other one is Jose Garcia Lopez, who was mainly at DC, and particularly when you see DC art on merchandise and things like that, Lopez is the one that created all of that. And so two of the three most prominent artists of the 1980s are Latino. But particularly with Perez, I think he suffers in that regard because, except for Wonder Woman, he's not necessarily the writer of these characters. Even someone like White Tiger, who is Marvel's first Puerto Rican hero, Perez is the one that draws his first appearance. But even Perez would say the idea of creating White Tiger came from the white writer Bill Mantlo, not Perez. Where you see Perez's background intersecting with a character is more with DC's Cyborg, in that he's growing up in a similar kind of neighborhood as Perez did as a child. And there's kind of more connection with the Latino Perez to the African-American character of Cyborg in terms of how their backgrounds feed into each other. But within comics, I think part of it is that Perez as an artist, I don't know that his background as a Latino man necessarily factored in, because he was a well-beloved fan favorite fairly quickly. And so within the world of comics, I don't know that he necessarily experienced that prejudice directly, nor do I see that necessarily as something that's factoring into his neglect. If anything, we probably neglect how his background might play into some of the things that he's doing.
And so let's stay with that. You've given us some sense about why he might be neglected. What are the other things when he was nominated for the Hall of Fame? He got, this is what he did, this is what he did, and, oh, well, he was my favorite partner.
There's a lot of factors that I talk about. One of them is Perez's own transparency as an artist, that Perez as an artist is someone whose art served the story primarily and wasn't about drawing attention to himself. And so that's, I think, a very important thing, is that he's not an artist. Even though his style is immediately recognizable, it never kind of breaks the comic book page. It never draws attention to itself to the detriment of the story. Because of that, there's kind of an invisibility to what Perez does in his art. And so I think that that's one of the major factors, is that for Perez, the art always served the story. And I think he even said some things to the effect that he saw himself not as an artist, someone who should draw attention to himself, that it should always be in the service of the story. And then there's other factors within the industry as well, particularly when Perez is working as an artist, there's much more emphasis on the writer, that the writer is the figure that's responsible for the comic, that the artist is just kind of following along with the, you know, the script that he was given, and things like that. Because some writers would give a much more detailed page one, panel one, here's what it is, panel two, here's what it is. So there is kind of a way in which the artist is treated secondary to the writer in a lot of ways. And Perez, I think, suffers from that as well, because what allows some artists to rise out of that is when they become both writer and artist. Perez, but for, it's something like 7 issues of his Wonder Woman run where he's both writer and artist, is always working with someone else. There's always another writer attached. Even when he's doing the plots for Wonder Woman, there was another writer that was doing the script and filling in the dialogue balloons and stuff like that for a long time. We talk about comic book artists in terms of auteur theory from film, that you have sort of writers and artists like John Byrne and Frank Miller and Walt Simonson that have long runs on series, you know, 3, 4, 5 years, where they're the writer and the artist. And so it's very much shaped by their vision. Perez doesn't have that. He had a 5-year run on Wonder Woman, so like close to 60 issues. There's 8 where he's actually just both writer and artist. Otherwise, he's working with another writer, or he's the writer and has given up the artistic duties on the series. So he doesn't have that long run as both writer and artist that would have cemented him more, I think, in people's eyes as that kind of auteur artist.
What about the impact of his style on later artists who work in the medium?
Yeah, you can see a lot of artists that follow in kind of his footsteps, particularly in terms of the sheer detail that they include and also the energy that they give to it. One that I would say that's working today is Pepe Larraz, who's mainly doing work at Marvel. I think he's the artist for the new Amazing Spider-Man series that launch is tomorrow as we're taping this, and has worked on Avengers and other sort of big Marvel series. I see a lot of the same kind of detail, the same kind of energy in his work as in Perez. Another one who very much is very similar to Perez is Phil Jimenez, who was an artist at DC, came after Perez, but is about as close to Perez as an artist as one could be and not be Perez. The same detail, same sort of stretching of the page and things like that. So he's had a massive influence on the artists that have come after him, that there's a lot that you can point to as, yeah, they're definitely working in that Perez sort of vein, but again, not something that Perez has necessarily been recognized for.
We learn, too, that he was not well. He could have gone perhaps on, but he did have health issues.
Yeah, he had health issues. He suffered from cataracts for a long time, diabetes, and then, of course, he died from pancreatic cancer, which was discovered not long after he retired in 2019, passed away in 2022 as I was working on the book, which sort of made it even more, that added a lot of pressure in terms of wanting to sort of honor his memory after his passing so soon. So yeah, towards the end of his life, he had a number of health issues. And yeah, retired from comics in 2019.
And what does it say that even though he didn't get his wish, that he had hoped that he would die with an unfinished page on his drawing board?
Yeah, I think in some ways I use that as a metaphor for what I kind of hope the book will do, in that obviously his pages were not unfinished, but we haven't really done him justice in terms of what his significance within the comic industry and comic book style and things like that have been. And so in a lot of ways, I'm hoping the book is a first step in kind of reevaluating Perez's work and its importance, because no one would deny that he is a titan of the industry, that he's one of the most important superhero artists working, particularly in the 70s and 80s. There's just no denying that. But despite that, we don't really credit him with the kinds of contributions to the page and the world building in comics as, when you look back at him, he definitely did.
And you talked with me before saying that this month, April, there are some characters in the air, literally in the air online, that were his.
Yeah, so in the Daredevil Born Again series that's currently running on Disney Plus, they've got a storyline with the White Tiger character that he helped create in Deadly Hands of Kung Fu. The storyline they're doing is one that was much, much later. So not a storyline that Perez was involved with, but Perez did create the White Tiger character along with writer Bill Mantlo. And then, yeah, April is the 40th anniversary of DC's Crisis on Infinite Earths limited series, which was, in celebration of their 50th anniversary, sought to streamline their continuity into something more manageable, so brought together all of the characters in their universe over the course of 12 issues. Perez drew the whole thing with Marv Wolfman. And next to, you know, he did Teen Titans, then he did Crisis, then he did Wonder Woman. That's kind of his triumvirate at DC, and Crisis is very much a Perez project. It's every character in the DC universe coming together at some point. So he drew practically everyone. And again, you would just have armies of characters on the page, because that's another signature of his style. If he could pack more into a page, then he would. The page that I use in the book from Hulk Future Imperfect, which is kind of Rick Jones' museum of superhero artifacts. Peter David, I think, gave him a list of like five or six things that he wanted in there. And it's literally a two-page spread filled with hundreds of Easter eggs and things that you can point to. And that's just kind of what Perez did. If he could draw something into a page, he would.
Not just because he could, but because he thought it was more alive.
I think one of the things that I sort of credit Perez with is embracing what's possible on the comic book page. Particularly in the early days of superhero cinema, if you think of like your early X-Men films and things like that, they very much steered away from the more flamboyant aspects of the comics, largely out of budget concerns. Like you couldn't do on screen what you could do on the page. And so that's why the X-Men were all in black leather rather than their bright, colorful costumes and things like that. Perez very much embraces the more flamboyant, sort of colorful aspects of the comics in a way that you could only do on the comic book page. I think one of the ones I talk about, the character Taskmaster that he helped to create, who in the comics he's basically the guy that trains all the anonymous thugs that every supervillain has. You know, he's very much behind the scenes, kind of working in secret, but he's wearing a giant blue and orange outfit with a giant white cape. I think he's got orange buccaneer boots on. He's got like a skull mask. Like there's no reason for someone in that kind of behind the scenes job to dress like that, except it's in a comic book and we can do those kinds of things. And those more kind of flamboyant, almost veering on the ridiculous aspects of comics, I think Perez's art embraces, because it's not something we need to be embarrassed about. This is what comics can do. This is the fun of comics. It doesn't have to be based in realism. And I think that's something that I credit Perez with, very much embracing kind of the imaginative possibilities of what you can do in comics.
And is that why you love comics and collect them?
Yes. Yeah. That. And again, it makes sense given that Perez was there at the beginning of my comics obsession, that that's what I sort of embrace in comics and that I think is so much fun in comics. And the films have caught up to it somewhat today. You know, the characters much more look like they're wearing their comic book costumes than they once did. So we're finally at the point where film can do more of what comics can do, but comics can do it on less than a $30 million or $300 million budget.
Patrick Hamilton, professor of English at Misericordia University in Dallas, Pennsylvania, speaking with us about his new study titled George Perez, about one of the most important superhero artists working in the 70s and 80s, recently issued by the University Press of Mississippi. Dr. Hamilton has co-authored a book titled All New, All Different, A History of Race and the American Superhero, with Dr. Alan Austin, who is also on the faculty at Misericordia University. And together they are co-hosts of the WVIA podcast Pop Shop, heard on WVIA Radio Saturdays at 6, and also online as a podcast at WVIA.org. This evening, we have a chance to celebrate or get a sense of one of the characters created by George Perez. And that's the finale from the Marvel television series Daredevil, Born Again. And the series includes the character Hector Ayala, known as White Tiger, created by George Perez and Bill Mantlow. And that's this evening on Disney Plus, the season finale of Daredevil, Born Again from Marvel television. For more information about the book by Patrick Hamilton, titled simply George Perez, upress.state.ms.us, and that's the publisher, and that's the University Press of Mississippi. It's George Perez by Patrick Hamilton, and it's been issued by the University Press of Mississippi, and you can find more information at upress.state.ms.us.